Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. In this episode, we'll hear an interview with Kathy Kelly, longtime political activist, Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. But first, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
There is not a single black national media organization dedicated to fighting for net neutrality. Not one. It is as if 40 million African Americans have no interest in ensuring that the new media that are swiftly coming to dominate our political, economic, and social lives operate in ways that serve the people with the least resources, meaning masses of black people, rather than giant corporations. Black people's most basic interests should dictate that African Americans lead the way in demanding a democratic internet, to make sure that deeply ingrained patterns of wealth and privilege are not reproduced far into the digital future in internet content and access. The black stake in the internet is both obvious and critical, as it is for Latinos, who at least have one organization, the National Hispanic Media Coalition, that is committed to net neutrality. Yet, 40 million black people have no one fighting for them on the digital front lines. Why is black America stumbling into the new media future with literally no protection from corporate abusers? The answer is simple. We have been sold out yet again by the black misleadership class, one of the most selfish and self-dealing gaggles of folks on earth. Back in the days when cable television was the new media, black politicians and community groups responded to the corporate challenge by ensuring that companies were required to wire every neighborhood in a city or county. Black folks knew that, left to their own devices, the new cable companies would only wire the affluent sides of town and leave the rest of us in a media desert. 30 years later, the issues of content and access remain essentially the same, but the giant telecommunications companies have learned that the black misleadership class can be easily bought. The turning point came in 2006, when millions in corporate bribes in the form of campaign contributions and so-called charity neutralized black opposition to legislation that, as Bruce Dixon wrote at the time, would turn the free and open information superhighway into a corporate toll road and lift regulations that force cable and telephone companies to serve poor and minority areas. In addition to the massive bribery of black politicians and so-called civil rights organizations, the telecoms pressured thousands of their black employees to staff phone banks, inundating black office holders with pleas on behalf of their bosses. 2/3 of the Congressional Black Caucus betrayed their own people's vital communications interests, and organized black resistance to the telecoms was wiped out. Now another corporate offensive is underway, and black lines of defense are virtually non-existent. If you want to know where Tom Joyner and the NAACP's Ben Jealous all converge with the Tea Party, look to the ranks of those opposing internet neutrality. The black luminaries and misleaders are sipping cocktails with the Tea Partiers at the digital corporate bar. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. We now feature an interview with Kathy Kelly, longtime political activist, Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. The following interview with Kathy Kelly was recorded on Friday, September 10th, 2010. We are joined on the phone with Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly is a longtime peace and justice activist who coordinates an organization internationally renowned called Voices for Creative Nonviolence, online at vcnv.org. Voices for Creative Nonviolence is a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare, and she is joining us on the phone from Nevada. Kathy Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitchell. It's a privilege to be on with you.
It's a privilege to have you with us. So you're in Las Vegas, Nevada, as I understand it.
That's right. Four of us from the Chicago area drove out in Libby Papillardo's Prius so that we could come to a trial, and we don't really know exactly when we might be returning back to Chicago, although we'd be pleased if we were able to have a very full hearing of the testimony, the evidence that we think would prove that when we entered into Creech Air Force Base April 9th, 2009, we weren't acting as criminals. We, in fact, were enacting our obligations to protest against crimes against the peace, war crimes. And by that, we mean the usage of drones for massive targeted assassinations, for extrajudicial killings. And this is killing people in Pakistan where we aren't even at war. We can't even begin to say, well, we're a nation at war. And these aren't actions made in self-defense, especially when we kill children, as we've done in Afghanistan repeatedly.
So your Creech Air Force Base is in Nevada, and you're going on trial. Why are you on trial?
Well, we were accused, charged with a criminal trespass to a military installation, and this is under Nevada state law. We had vigiled outside the base for 10 days, holding up signs that said, ground the drones lest ye reap the whirlwind. We had, in fact, been written up in the paper the morning of August 9th, which reported that we would plan to enter the base. And we had a letter that we wanted to circulate amongst the Air Force personnel, encouraging them to really think hard about the possibility that all of us are guilty of war crimes if we don't try hard to stop the usage of targeted assassinations, which is really the strategy of choice combined with night raids and death squads that the Obama administration has said it's going to rely on. So we think this is so serious. We, on April 9th, 2009, were taking it seriously. That's why we entered the base after 10 days. We sauntered in, really. There was no sign that said that we couldn't. We saw others walk onto the base, and so we walked on with our letter. And when we were told to stop by a very nervous security Air Force personnel person who clicked his rifle on and looked like he might be ready to shoot, we did immediately stop, and we knelt down or sat down. And after about an hour, we were taken by paddy wagons and squad cars to the Las Vegas jail, and there we were jailed overnight. We were arraigned, and we were told to appear. And then charges were dropped, so we never did appear in Nevada until more recently. Charges were reinstated, but the government has had 10 months to prepare its case against us. And this morning we learned that the prosecutor wanted to ask for a continuance because he felt that he didn't have enough time. And we thought, well, we've come a long way, and we've spent, truthfully, most of these past 10 months in one form or another, arranging to have expert witnesses. We've called on Bill Quigley, the legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, Colonel Anne Wright, who herself is a diplomat and helped to set up the embassy in Afghanistan just before the U.S. began the shock and awe bombardment, and also the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. And these are some of the people who are most qualified to comment on the relevance of international law and constitutional law to our case. And I really think it unnerved the prosecutor, plus we're all representing ourselves per se. And the 14 people who've come are people with impeccable credentials as peace activists, educators. We're talking about people who, Franciscan priests, Jesuit priests. There are a sister from the Religious Congregation of the Sisters of the Sacred Heart, people who have run Catholic worker houses and who have traveled to war zones, and people who have really had many, many decades of experience, like Brad Little from Chicago, who is a renowned peace activist. And so they should hear. They should really hear our testimony and hear the testimony of expert witnesses. And we were relieved to know that after Bill Quigley gave a call to the prosecutor, 15 minutes later, I think perhaps in conversation with the judge, he changed his mind and said they won't seek a continuance. Now, we think they will seek to eliminate any of our testimony on the part of expert witnesses or talking about our own motivations even. But the most important thing is, can we put these drones on trial? Can we help people understand the people who are bearing the brunt of the drone targeted attacks? And so often, those people are children, they're women, they're grandmothers, they're people who happen to live in the same homes as people that the U.S. calls HVTs, high-value targets. And the United States is raising the likelihood that other countries will also institutionalize targeted assassination. This is frightening, and this should be frightening to every elected official here, too.
There are a number of questions that come to mind related to the presentation that you just gave. I, you know, you answered a question, but I consider it practically a presentation. Let's start with the base itself. It seems to me that you're targeting this base, particularly because it seems to be involved with the connections of the drones. Is that the reason or why of the myriad of potential military-related targets in the United States and maybe worldwide? Why go all the way to Nevada to protest this particular base?
Well, this is the base where the operators are responsible for not only surveillance of Afghanistan, but also when the orders are given, and they're part of the kill chain, firing Hellfire missiles and 500-pound bombs on targets in Afghanistan. And, I mean, for instance, about 5 days ago, there were six little kids out helping to collect scrap metal that they would use to, you know, bring in some income for their families. And nearby, an Afghan police station had been targeted and attacked by supposedly, allegedly, Taliban fighters. Well, the surveillance apparently indicated that these children were high-value targets, and the kill chain kicked into discussion, should we or shouldn't we? And then the decision was made, yes, we have to bomb the targets that we're seeing on these mountainsides because we think that these are the Taliban that have already scattered. And they fired their missiles, and six children, aged 6 to 12, were instantly killed, carbonized. But those children committed no crime. And the villagers were just aghast. These were children. And you can read of other instances just in the past month where three brothers in the Wardak province of Afghanistan were targeted as being insurgents. But then it turned out after a night raid went in to finish them off, that they were students. Two of them were students, and the other was a brother, and they were, you know, the younger one was too young to go away to school, but the oldest brother had come back from his studies to celebrate the Ramadan feast of breaking the fast on the first day of Ramadan with his family. Well, again, the villagers were outraged. Now, this isn't making us safer. This is sending spirals of enraged feelings throughout villages in Afghanistan, in areas where people hadn't even been experiencing any fighting. In the north of Afghanistan, somehow the surveillance determined that the second car in a convoy was carrying Taliban fighters. Well, it turned out the convoy was carrying people who were campaigning for elections that the U.S. has been telling Afghanistan they have to hold. And even President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan came out and said, you've got to stop this. Stop killing our civilians.
Going back a moment to one point you had raised regarding the coverage about this within the Nevada and Las Vegas community, and certainly your protest related to it, you had said that there was a you had a letter published in the Las Vegas Journal, whose name escapes me for the moment. What was the receptivity that you've gotten from Nevadans and from others in the nearby communities? Did they cheer you? Did they support you? Did they spit at you? What was their reaction, or was there one?
Well, the people at the base have been very friendly. We've had peace signs and waves and hellos. It's a bit different this time because there's so much construction going on at the base. It's remarkable. There are regular arrivals of cement trucks and all kinds of construction vehicles, and Now, I'm sure the base provides jobs and people, you know, don't particularly see themselves as contributing to war crimes. They're just making deliveries and helping to expand the base. But the base apparently is now becoming a top security facility. And the usage of drones is also expanding to Ellsworth Base in South Dakota and Whiteman Air Force in Missouri. So, you know, I suppose most people think that we look fairly harmless and maybe they like our signs. Our signs say to counter terror, build justice, and put drones on trial. A lot of people who have trained as Air Force personnel to fly planes, to get in a cockpit and pull down the lid and, you know, take off on a runway themselves, may not be so keen on the idea of always every day going into a dimly lit trailer and staring at a computer screen. And, you know, there's kind of a joke that goes around that says, hey, I heard you got the Purple Heart, what for? And the answer is carpal tunnel. You know, that they're just operating these levers. But the problem, of course, is that this isn't a joke for people in Pakistan or Afghanistan. I know of a 14-year-old boy who can't fall asleep at night, Isra Khandawar, because the sound of the drones is getting closer, and he's afraid, you know, in this icy, clammy fear that maybe tonight will be the night that the drone hits his house and kills all of his family members. And what can he do? Absolutely nothing. You can't run. You can't hide. These drones go faster. And the stories just keep on coming. I was in Pakistan last month, and no, I'm sorry, I'm going next month, and I was there 3 months ago in June of 2010. And a journalist, Safdar Dawar, and another fellow, a social worker who chose not to give us his name, said, we have a question for you. Do your people in the United States know about the usage of drones over Pakistan? Do they understand what the consequences of these drone attacks are in our villages and cities? And I kind of hesitated, and I said, well, yeah, many do. And he said, but is it in your mainstream press? And I said, well, that's why we're here. We're trying. And then they just stopped me and said, where is your democracy if your people don't know about this? Why isn't it being discussed? And then, you know, I guess they saw that I was looking kind of crestfallen and, you know, we're doing our best. And one man said, the journalist said, look, it's because we care about you. We want you to know. The hatred is rising. It's a really big problem here. The hatred is rising. So people should understand that we can't let reckless policies go forward without any discussion and expect that people will have friendly feelings toward us in other countries.
To return back a moment to the trial, I found it curious when you had mentioned that you had been charged, then the charges were dropped, and now they apparently have been reinstated. I, at least for the moment, can't recall any instance where that's ever happened. Why do you think, if you have any guesses or if you know, why the charges were basically brought back from extinction?
Well, it may be because after we did this action, several people from Code Pink with a ton of energy came out and did another action, a follow-up action, and then there was a third action with the Nevada Desert Experience and the Pache Bene group, and I think that, you know, the people at the base and the people in the sheriff's offices might have thought, well, we've got to create a deterrent. We don't want to be dealing with these people. They're a nuisance. So if you can saddle people with heavy fines and, you know, drag them across country to appear in court and use things that are intended to intimidate, then maybe you'll, you know, inspire people not to do this anymore. They'll think this is too much of a burden. But we don't think that. We certainly found it quite expensive to travel all the way out to Nevada and to bring in these expert witnesses. And this has been, you know, enormous hours of work on the part of many people. But that's what democracy is about. And we're willing to pay that price. We've also been able to educate many, many people because we didn't have enough money to accomplish this. So we held fundraisers in Des Moines, Iowa, and on the south side of Chicago at St. Irenaeus Parish. My goodness, people were extraordinarily generous toward us. And out in McHenry County, people collectively have raised thousands of dollars, and that's why we're able to do this. And now we're responsible to report back to all of them. And I've been doing media interviews all day, and so have at least four or five other people involved in this. Bill Quigley's been on some national media radio shows talking about the case as an expert witness. This is something that they can't control as much as they would like to. But I think that courts like to be able to control the cases, and they don't like the defendants getting an upper hand.
And that actually brings me to my next question. So, barring a continuance, it sounds like that there will be a trial. And I don't know if this might be too much to ask as far as you tipping your hand to what you may say. And if so, just tell me. But what do you plan to say when the time comes to testify in your behalf?
Well, we believe that the evidence will show that under the principles set forth by the Nuremberg trials, and according to the Constitution, which says that when the United States signs a treaty, it becomes the law of the land. And the United States signed on to the Geneva Accords, which resulted from the Nuremberg Trials. All of that literature states clearly, and more recently, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings stated clearly that this drone use raises legal problems, that it's wrongful to engage in targeted assassinations when you're not at war against a country, and that it's, even if you are at war, that it's wrongful to use lethal force using conventional weapons against a civilian population, and that's what the United States has been doing with the drone attacks. So we think that the evidence will show that we, in fact, acted in accord with our duties and obligations as citizens of the United States. And we also think that the evidence will show that the Air Force has basically usurped its right to control that territory because they themselves have been acting in violation of international law and domestic law.
Suasive cases notwithstanding, some people may argue that the current reality may suggest that it may be hard to convince an American judge, particularly one whom you may be likely to face as one of being a probably politically conservative bent, of this fact, even if you can draw a compelling case with evidence and facts and things like that. Are you afraid or are you concerned that a judge may still nonetheless punish you or dismiss your case? And I'm not saying dismiss as in drop the charges or refuse the charges, but dismiss in rejecting your arguments simply because that judge may not feel that there's enough of a burden of international law that could be brought to bear in this case?
Well, then we go to the Court of U.S. Public Opinion, which is also important. But, you know, on June 14th of this past summer, I was part of a case in Washington, D.C., which had fairly similar charges. We had crossed into the rotunda of the Capitol building, and we put down a banner that bore the names of three people who allegedly had committed suicide at Guantanamo, but later Scott Horton demonstrated, I think very compellingly, that they quite likely were tortured to death. And so we wanted to remember their lives and reach out to their loved ones, and so we put their names on a very beautiful scroll, and we poured rose petals, and then in a rather loud voice, so that we could be heard throughout the rotunda, we talked about what we were doing and why, and then we joined in singing a very peaceful song. It was a South African song sung when people were being carried off to torture and to possible death by their loved ones. So we did this, and we were acquitted. The judge allowed Bill Quigley to present the evidence. Our other people, companions and co-defendants, were outside with banners on the Capitol steps. And the prosecution tried to prove that we were a breach of the peace and possibly inciting others to violence. And the judge really kind of dressed down the prosecution and said, look, I don't find that to be the case at all. You haven't proven that. And so we wonder, will the prosecution be able to prove that we created such a disturbance of the peace? Whose peace did we disturb? There were no signs that said you can't walk onto that base. Other people were walking on and off the base, and we stopped as soon as we were told to stop.
That actually kind of evokes what you had said earlier in this interview about what strikes me as a really disproportionate response of people drawing weapons and a lot of cars surrounding 14, and I would presume unarmed, and you know, activists speaking openly of peace.
Well, that really describes exactly what happened, and we have video footage of it as well. I certainly welcome people to go to our website, vcnv.org, and there should be a YouTube posted of that video, and we'll certainly try to get other video out as well. So, that's what I think people would see, that we're a group of people who don't pose a threat to anyone, but we're trying to oppose a very real threat, which happens if we're asleep at the wheel and we don't start paying attention to what's developing in the 21st century military as it increasingly becomes robotized. It's a big question, and we must look at it.
I'd like to turn away from the state of affairs, at least, that you're immediately working on regarding the trial in Las Vegas, and actually talk about you and your work for a little bit. You've been very well regarded in peace and activist communities, not only in Chicago, but worldwide, regarding your particular work. And I'd just like to ask, what is it that inspires you and keeps you going amidst all the work that you're doing, fighting what seems to be a uphill struggle probably a lot of the time? Where's the fire in your belly?
When I was left in Afghanistan, I had a chance to just sit down on the grass with five or six little boys. They were all badly injured by landmines or remote control devices or bombs or, one little boy didn't know which side it hit him. He got caught in the crossfire. Another wouldn't come out with us because he was just so badly battered in his body. He had been out trying to collect scrap metal, and he found a landmine, and he was so excited. You know, this could really bring a lot of money if he could just extract the brass, and it blew up in his hand and ripped four fingers off his hand and destroyed one eye. And the other boys sitting on a sheet outside in the hospital garden and helping one another to limp out there and settle down on the grass, they exchanged their stories, and they talked about how sorry they were for Nur Said, and they hoped that someday he could feel better, come and join them. And little Esmatullah, age 7 years old, his arm completely shattered because he had been hit by a bomb blast. Those children don't mean us any harm. And they show us a real readiness to talk with people from different walks of life. I mean, some of them even needed translation. They came from different language groups from within Pakistan. But I think, what kind of future do we want to set forth for children in Afghanistan? 850 children die every single day in that country. 850 children die every single day. And we're spending $1 million to keep each soldier for one day, $1 million per soldier, for 1 year in Afghanistan. And every day, 7,000 Afghan drivers take their lives in their hands to drive across that country to bring supplies to feed the U.S. soldiers, and some of them are saying, we're becoming obese over here. It's not right. We don't want to live that way. We can't continue that way. So I'm inspired by children, by the possibility that we can create a better world for the children, to build a better world. What better way can we spend our lives? There's nothing I can imagine that's more important or more crucial right now. And when you engage in that, the gratifications are so tremendous. You get to rub shoulders with some of the finest people in the world, and you know that you're not involved in something that's kind of limiting. I know so many people are wanting to do the best for their kids, and that means, taking them to entertainment and sports events, a lot of entertainment and sports events. But we could change a bit and slow down and think about what's most important for the future of the children we love. And I think that will involve many of us in much more peace activism. And there's no downside to it, really. It's a vocation that we all deserve, and I hope people will feel welcome to join.
We've been speaking with Kathy Kelly. She is a longtime peace and justice activist who co-coordinates the renowned activist group Voices for Creative Nonviolence online at vcnv.org. Voices for Creative Nonviolence is a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. Kathy Kelly, very likely going to face trial for her activism at the Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and has been calling us from Las Vegas. Kathy, thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitchell. All best to you and your listeners.
That was Kathy Kelly, recorded on Friday, September 10th, 2010. Again, the website of Kathy Kelly's group, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, is www.vcnv for Voices for Creative Nonviolence.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.